This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website or online portfolio. Stay tuned for details of how to get a 10% discount. Coming up today, it has been ruled that blocking access to the Pirate Bay is ineffective and ISP bans are being lifted, but only if you're Dutch, for the time being at least. Plus, the UK's GCHQ has been discovered to have been secretly spying on Facebook and YouTube in real time to predict trends and people's behaviour. Plus, we take a deeper look at online harassment and abuse. Is it getting worse? Why has it been such a widely discussed topic recently, and is enough being done to address the problem? All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting from science and tech to being immortal and being a troll. I'm Nate Langson, I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Leah Clark.
And today we've got several interesting topics to get into, and we're going to also be joined by Nicholas Tufnell in a little bit to talk about immortality and pre-life under the eyes of science. It's going to be an interesting one. And in the second half of the show, we've got a massive discussion topic about online harassment and what is being done to tackle it. So don't miss that. But first, the news. A Dutch court of appeal has ruled that internet service providers should not have to block the Pirate Bay at an IP and DNS level, since such measures are ineffective. Now, this is a case involving a Dutch anti-piracy group called Brian. I have no idea how to pronounce it, so we're just going to call it that group, which has been battling six ISPs in that country since 2010, during which time ISPs largely had to block the Pirate Bay. But this week, a court of appeals in The Hague overturned the most recent ruling that two of the ISPs should have to block the Pirate Bay. Now, this is really interesting because the court applied case law from the European Court of Justice, which held that an internet service provider should not be forced to take measures that are disproportionate and or ineffective.
Well, in that case, does it mean we're going to just see this happening all over the place now? Or it can happen in the UK?
Well, it sets an interesting example. I mean, it's not a UK precedent, but it's certainly, almost certainly going to get cited. But Liv looks like she's about to say something.
Well, no, it seems complete common sense that these site blocking techniques don't work. I would say that the group, the Hollywood-funded anti-piracy group, is going to try and appeal this decision, and then obviously not happy, and they say that it's out of line with some of the rulings that have taken place in other countries, and I presume he's referring to the UK in that instance.
Yeah, a lot of ISPs in the UK, certainly the major ones, all block the Pirate Bay and various other sites like Kickass Torrents and Torrent Hound and a bunch of other ones. And the thing is, the reason this case was so interesting is that the case law cited various research papers effectively that ruled that the Pirate Bay blockade has very little effect on curbing piracy. So since there was effectively evidence to the contrary of Pirate Bay blocking being a good idea, and since ISPs don't have to enforce things that are deemed to be ineffective, put two and two together and you get lifted bans. It's a fascinating result, I think.
Yeah.
Really fascinating result.
What I like particularly about this case is the guy who heads up the anti-piracy group, I can't remember what his name is now, but almost immediately, as soon as this guy started launching this case, they set up a proxy, some kind of funsters set up a proxy that was said F in his name, a dot whatever it was, but so you could go and access the Pirate Bay via this URL that was, you know, basically telling him to go away in a very extreme way.
It's interesting. That's one of the things that this blockade of the Pirate Bay has done, is that these sites are so easily portable from domain to domain. You know, you can host your own Pirate Bay. We could have a wired Pirate Bay if you want. You can host it on a USB stick. Yeah. You know, it's ridiculously easy. And so all we've seen is that as one gets shut down, another one pops up, then that one gets blocked, and there's sites like Kickass Unblock and Kick.as and all these sort of things that just exist to allow access to the data on the site because it's the actual domain that's being blocked, not the physical content.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see whether this applies to any UK ISPs down the line, but certainly I imagine it sets some alarm bells ringing across the rest of Europe and in the UK, because certainly ISPs don't want to be at a competitive disadvantage, and if one is seen, perhaps in one country at least, to not have to enforce this, then maybe others will want to follow. So we will return to this topic. Do you feel immortal? I feel a bit immortal right now, absolutely. But Nicholas Tufnell has joined us because he wrote this week about a study to do with immortality and perhaps souls and pre-life and various things, which sort of has an intersection between science and philosophy that we kind of was wanting to delve into a little bit, because it was a fascinating and slightly weird topic. So firstly, Nicholas, why did I feel immortal when I was born, apparently?
Well, according to a study by Natalie Emmons of Boston University, the tendency to reason in terms of maternal mind is a universal cognitive default, regardless of race, religion, or culture. So basically that means you felt immortal in your early years because, well, she doesn't really know why, but you certainly did. And it was a belief that you would have had that is also difficult to sort of shake off as you mature, even when you do understand scientifically that that's not true.
So this study is effectively saying that when we entered this world, we had this innate, this inherent feeling of immortality.
Yeah.
And it just wears off.
Absolutely. Something that you can't quite place, something you can't quite talk about, can't put into words, but this feeling that, yeah, before I was alive, there was something there. And I don't know what it was, but it was something. But curiously, nothing physical. It's an eternal mind, but not an eternal body.
So the reason we're talking about this, because this is not the Wired UK philosophy podcast. This is she's a psychologist that performed this study. And how exactly did she go about finding this out? Because she was speaking to children, various different kids, right?
Absolutely. So she focused on pre-life rather than afterlife, because afterlife is something that we all understand through religion in one form or another, or if not religion, you certainly would have encountered it in books, films, TV, etc. But pre-life is something that we don't really talk about. It's a bit more abstract. So she spoke to children, 283 children from two districts in Ecuador, about this notion of pre-life. Now, one of these groups of children she spoke to were an indigenous tribe from the area, and one in a more urban area, and all comprised of Roman Catholics. So the examination included presenting the children with drawings of a young woman, then that same woman pregnant, and that same woman, and then the baby that came out of the pregnant woman. And then she asked the children, using these pictures as prompts, you know, how did you feel at this stage? How did you feel at this stage? And then when she asked them, how did you feel when there was no baby, they then came out with the answer. But what was fascinating is that they all came out with the same answer, which was, well, I had these feelings of emotions that I can't quite place, but nonetheless they were there.
And this is regardless of the fact that one was raised with very strong religious understanding, or at least surrounded by quite a strong religious influence, and one was not.
Precisely. And that was what was so fascinating about it, because they were so different that all these assumptions that, oh, it comes from religious inculcation were proved entirely wrong.
But there's a slight flaw in the methodology, in my opinion, in that they had to speak to kids who were already old enough to be able to talk about this, which means that it's quite likely that they have been influenced by any of the, you know, all of the conversations that they've had, or all of the adults around them, whether or not it's about religion or not. They may be aware that they came from their parents, and kind of having some kind of understanding of that means that it wouldn't be an inherent belief necessarily. It could just be a learned kind of belief that feels like it's inherent because it's from such a young age.
Leah, do you remember feeling at all immortal when you were born?
I think, you don't think about your life ever not existing, but you don't think about it in those kinds of terms, do you, when you're a child? But I think I did have an innate sense of immortality. Mm. I also found out that I believed in God when I was a child, even though neither of my parents did.
Interesting. And so I feel immortal.
How to explain that.
So, Nicholas, what does this tell us? What can we take from this? I'm assuming her research is going on. I mean, what's the ultimate goal to find out here?
Well, she doesn't really know why this happened, you know, or why we have this particular response. She suspects that it might be a byproduct of our developed social reasoning, which is our highly developed social reasoning, in that we're constantly searching for meaning, and out of that we can better understand ourselves and other people. And so it may well be that it's actually easier for us to assume this pre-life. We get on better that way, and therefore we end up thinking what scientifically we can't actually prove, but feel is true.
Well, for Nicholas's full report on this study, do go to wired.co.uk and search for, Immortal will probably bring this up. Nicholas, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Spying, that's the topic of our next discussion, GCHQ specifically. It is believed Facebook and YouTube were snooped upon in real time to check for trends about you, Liat, and
yes.
You listening on your headphones on that train right now, you.
All of you
may have been spied on. What's going on, Liat? This is getting dark, dangerous.
It is serious stuff. This is all because of yet another Edward Snowden leak. NBC News published a PowerPoint presentation that shows basically a strategy GCHQ had devised called Squeaky Dolphin, which, please, readers, can you tell us what you think that's about? Because
Flipper.
I couldn't figure out. Why?
That was my dolphin impression.
Thanks, Liv.
That was great.
Thanks.
But anyway, this presentation was done by the GCHQ to show the NSA how they had generated this real-time dashboard to demonstrate activity of social media use, including YouTube, and later on in the presentation, Facebook.
Quick question. What makes this any different to me going on YouTube and looking at what's most popular? Because all that data is public.
That's what I had thought. But they can also, from the information, according to experts NBC News spoke to, what they showed in the presentation demonstrated that they could, in fact, go in on individual users if they so chose. And that the way they were gathering the data was direct from internet cables. So, which is something we knew about from previous leaks. But they're saying this is how they are collating all that mass information that they are getting direct from the cables. And this was without Google's knowledge. And Google, I spoke with a representative, and they're not best pleased about this. So this is more than just looking at likes.
So what were they trying to find out? What were they trying to achieve by monitoring this trend data?
This was the interesting part, because beyond, I mean, they mentioned stuff like they're collating URLs liked on Facebook, blog visits, stuff like that. But they term the whole thing broad real-time monitoring activity. And the headline for the presentation is, it's basically about human psychology and what they can garner from this information. So some of the examples in the presentation related to trends that they had identified prior to anti-government protests in Bahrain, for example. They could find out what people were searching from or liking or watching on YouTube just prior to that happening. And also randomly, people that liked links related to former Defence Secretary Liam Fox and cricket-related activities in England. Slightly less less serious activities.
What, so they're trying to map patterns of YouTube viewing to kind of public revolution?
Well, I think that the point is, yeah, actually homing in on specific regions and seeing what the public sentiment is there. And the presentation, it's a PowerPoint slide, so it doesn't have loads of description, but it has things like a graph which cites a study comparing the big five personality traits with what web browsers individuals use and what that means. So they found things like Internet Explorer users are generally more agreeable and less neurotic, and Firefox users are less likely to be extroverts. And there's all these studies cited, and things like how, you know, behaviors online demonstrate certain personalities, and things like mirroring and mimicking people's language. So this is obviously, I mean, when we talk about the kind of mass surveillance, it often sounds like it could be fairly useless unless you are homing in on individuals, which they say they're not, unless they have reason to.
But this is proper mass surveillance, trying to find meaning in all of that data.
That's what it sounds like. That's what it looks like from the presentation.
But NSA and GCHQ have both said that everything they do is legal and proportionate. Yeah. As in they don't look unless they have a need to.
Well, I mean, that's what they've been saying all along. But then at the same time, they've been going direct to Twitter and Facebook and Google with warrants for information. So why GCHQ is accessing internet cables directly to and not informing Google or Facebook that they're doing this, which Google and Facebook have said, is a mystery and suggests perhaps... Perhaps it's not entirely legal, but I'm sure they'll say otherwise.
Well, it could be to do with the fact that if a real-time interception is the first flag that somebody may be involved in something nefarious, and perhaps previous data has not been captured, then subpoenaing a company like Facebook for data that preceded the interception could be a reason still to do that.
It seems odd that they wouldn't have any knowledge of it whatsoever. And I mean, they've argued that also they might just be using a third party to access the cables, in which case I guess they're the only ones that had to receive a warrant.
Well, for more information on this, secretly go and type GCHQ Facebook into wider.co.uk for more on this story. Coming up after the break, we've got a little bit of feedback to get into, and then we're going to jump into our main and single discussion topic for this show on the subject of online harassment. This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create professional websites or online portfolios. Squarespace is offering free domain names and customizable website designs, drag-and-drop tools, 24/7 support, and if you want to sell physical goods, digital downloads, maybe you want to charge for a podcast, who knows? You can do that by using the systems baked into each template and on responsive website designs that are scaled to look appropriate on devices from mobile size up to desktop. You can give it a go now. You can get a free trial without putting in a credit card if you go to squarespace.com/wiredUK. Plans start from £5 a month, and you can get a 10% off offer code, which is WIRED1, when you go to that website. Get a yearly plan, get a free domain, and get some money off. That's squarespace.com/wiredUK. Welcome back. Now, we're going to dive into just a little bit of feedback from you. You can always send feedback to us at podcast@wired.co.uk, or you can leave comments on the stories on wired.co.uk, of course. And we've got a couple that we wanted to get to this week. Liv, start us off. We were talking about Kim.com's Baboom streaming service that only has his album last week. And I was a bit down on the idea. And Jamie has written in with some thoughts.
Yeah, well, Kim's Baboom, of course, was offering up his own music for free and encouraging people to donate money, whatever they saw fit, based on accumulating money from viewing ads via a plugin. But anyway, Jamie says, right, so according to him, artists should devalue their work into throwaway free downloads and just hope that all the expensive studio time or equipment and mastering will get paid for by people, quote unquote, really liking the music or from advertising. This is appalling. You wouldn't expect an artist to hang McDonald's logos next to a painting in a gallery to support their careers, nor would you expect movies to ever get made if the entire budget were based on guessing what people might pay for at the cinema if they really feel like it.
I agree. I think the McDonald's art logo is a really apt comparison, actually, because we think about this in terms of listening to audio, but actually all art could be subject to this same
idea. True. Unfortunately, art isn't as easily copyable and uploadable.
True. Although the daft thing is that in a way, I think a lot of modern advertising is basically the best form of art.
Yeah.
In a way, it's amazing what advertising can convey in 10 seconds.
But also, when I spoke to Kim last year, and I don't know if this was made as clear.
Kim, first name terms, of course, now Liv.
I don't know if it was made clear in the story about the Baboom launch, which happened in, last week, was that he said that the artists would be able to set their own prices for their music and sell directly as opposed to via the labels. So he is going to be offering artists the option of selling their music. At least that's what he told me. Perhaps it's changed, but his own album is being offered for free.
Thank you, Jamie, for the email. Well, Graham wrote in to comment on the Facebook co-founder who said the email is dead. Graham says, sadly, the Facebook co-founder is mistaken. There is no evidence to support the notion that email is going to die. Indeed, we have had this argument every few years since email began almost 50 years ago. Email management is another thing altogether. People just don't know how to manage email, and they look for technology rather than at themselves and at their own behavior. It's rather like looking for a technological answer to dealing with the snail mail post that comes through the letterbox. People just don't do that. They adjust their own behavior. The answer to excess email is adjusting behaviors, not looking for technological solutions. So it's your fault if you find email fatiguing, I think, is the comment being made there. What do you reckon, Liv? Leah?
I think technology could help us out.
Yeah, I feel like the email is an area where technology can help. I use Unroll Me, which is a mass unsubscribe tool, and that has helped a little bit, not enormously.
Interesting. I tend to find just putting in keywords that I tend to find tedious and annoying into mail and just have them automatically go into my trash. It's amazing how much...
What? Give me an example of a keyword.
Sex toys is a common one, actually.
Oh, well, we get some great stories about sex toys.
But I don't write about them.
Okay.
So I find them to be tedious in the email. So
often the word unsubscribe is a good one to look for.
Yes, that's quite that's a good one. Anything that has Liat Clark in the from line, straight into the bin. Obviously, I'm joking. I read all your emails. Have to. Well, you can get in touch with us at podcast@wired.co.uk if you have any feedback. We're going to get into the second half of our show, discussions and segments. Now, we've got one segment in the second half of today's program because it's a big one and we want to get really into it. And it is WWWTF.
What the?
Now, Liv wrote an epic and very comprehensive feature that we published this week called When Good Lulls Go Bad, Unpicking the Ugly Business of Online Harassment. Fab headline, fab article. Where do we begin with this, really, Liv? We want to talk about online harassment. We want to talk about some of the information, ideas and thoughts that you uncovered during your reporting on this topic.
Yeah. Well, in the past week or so, we've had quite a number of high-profile cases when it comes to the issue of online harassment, which now we seem to call trolling, whether or not it was according to the original meaning of trolling, but that's beside the point. So we had ex-footballer Stan Collymore coming out to criticise Twitter for not doing enough to prevent racist abuse, and he went on all the news channels to talk about this last week, I think. And then we also had two of the abusers of the feminist campaigner Caroline Criado Perez being jailed. They'd been convicted a few weeks before, but they've now got their jail sentences. And so I wanted to sort of get to the bottom of what actually constitutes online harassment and when police should be involved, whether the law is adequate, and what role sort of social networking sites should play, and even what role we should have. And so I spoke to loads of different people. I spoke to people who'd been harassed, really kind of grim cases. I spoke to lawyers, the police, and the social networking sites to try and find out.
So what sort of abuse is the focus here? I mean, is this someone, you know, like if you're a journalist and you're writing about things that are controversial, occasionally you'll get a lot of hate, but this is more severe than that, right?
Yeah, it's about trying to identify what is harassment and what is just someone with an opinion that you massively disagree with. So it's a kind of freedom of expression argument, and if it's not illegal, it's just someone being unpleasant.
Yeah, there's a line in your feature I remember that said something like, it's not illegal to be an asshole online.
No, it's not. You can have an objectionable, unpopular opinion and it's not illegal. What is illegal is harassment. And harassment law applies whether it's online or offline, and it includes things like kind of rape threats, homophobic abuse, racist abuse, and all of these are covered actually by existing pieces of legislation.
So you're saying we don't necessarily need new legislation at all?
No, well, I went into this article thinking, you know, the law is obviously not fit for purpose. We've had ridiculous cases like the Twitter joke trial where Paul Chambers made a threat about blowing up an airport, and it went, you know, round and round the courts with people trying to prosecute him for terrorist or menacing tweets, I think it was in the end. And eventually, I think it was 7 rounds in the court before common sense prevailed and he was off the hook. So on one hand, we're having the law being applied in a ridiculous case there. But on the other hand, we're having people like Caroline Criado Perez, like, you know, begging for the police to take action because she's getting loads and loads of rape threats. But in talking to lawyers and talking to the police, we have loads of laws to cover this. They're just not being applied as they should be. They're either being misapplied or they're not being applied when they should be.
And a question that I had for you when we were talking about this article was, some of the laws that are being applied, at least but incorrectly it transpires, but applied nonetheless, they're from a time pre-web.
Yeah.
You know, pre-internet almost in some of the cases. I mean, some of these laws date back to the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, we have laws that are created in 2005 that are arguably outdated at this point.
Yeah, well, what they're saying, and I think I agree on this point, is that harassment is harassment, whether you do it online, whether you do it over the telephone, whether you do it offline. There is a slight problem that I think people feel somehow as though it's less bad to say something online as it is to say something offline, but the law treats someone, if you're making threats against someone over Twitter, they treat it exactly the same as it would be treated if you were saying it to their face.
But equally, that mindset surely has to change in the police as well. The police are perhaps not picking up the cases or taking reports as seriously as they would if it were a real world problem.
Yes, and that does seem to be an issue. So one of the guys who was harassed, who I spoke to, a guy called Paul Burston, who was on the receiving end of horrendous of homophobic abuse, said that he was really concerned when he went to the police that they weren't going to take him seriously. And in the past, he'd found that there'd been cases where people hadn't been taken seriously. And a pretty big guy in the police called Andy Trotter, who handles a lot of the kind of media issues, he told me that yes, there could be more work done to make sure that when the frontline staff member in the police picks up the phone or meets someone in the station, they know how to handle these sorts of complaints. Because I think in the past people have been turned away.
So threats have to be, they have to be credible. It can't just be this guy's being an arse. It has to be I'm fearing that Something's going to happen.
And they have to prioritise. Police forces have been slashed. And so there were some interesting guidelines that were introduced last year to kind of help make sure we didn't have another Twitter joke trial. And yes, as you say, the harassment, the threats have to be credible. They have to be directed at an individual. So it can't just be, oh, I hate, an organisation, like, you know, if someone said I hate Wired, I don't think you wouldn't have an harassment case there. It has to be a course of conduct, so ongoing. So it can't just be a single tweet saying something horrendously offensive, although that would be bad. They're unlikely to pursue it, and it has to be intended to cause harm and intended to reach a wider audience. So again, that excludes cases where someone thinks they're just tweeting their girlfriend and then it gets retweeted by Stephen Fry. They're trying to avoid those things. And yes, and it has to be intended to cause harm to the recipient and the recipient feels harm. Some people are having very heated arguments where abuse is hurled in both directions. But if it's someone being victimized on an ongoing basis by a course of conduct with where they're not responding, those are the cases where the police are going to investigate.
But is it the role of the police? I mean, obviously there is a role for the police here because harassment, as you rightly say, is harassment. But the social networks are facilitating this.
Yeah.
Is it, I mean, are they not the front line here? You know, is it Twitter's job to prevent this? Is it Facebook's job? Is the police the second or third line in this? You know, are they the third people you should go to?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is both Twitter and Facebook have terms and service. First of all, they have to abide within the laws in which they operate. So they have to abide by harassment laws in theory. Secondly, they have terms of service which prevent bullying and harassment, regardless of whether they're, you know, illegal or not. They have their own terms of service. The problem is that they don't necessarily, they're not as good as policing it as each other. I think Facebook's actually done a really good job. I spoke to Facebook's UK head of policy, and I think, and they have a huge team of people dealing with cases. You can report, you know, every comment you don't like, you can report, you can hide stuff, even if it's not, you know, illegal, you can hide stuff. And they will contact the police if they think someone's at serious risk of being threatened in a way that might affect their real world life, is what they, how they phrase it. Twitter, on the other hand, seems to be less good. You can report stuff, but it doesn't seem to be acting quickly enough, and it doesn't seem to be handing over details of the worst offenders as quickly as it should be to help the police.
I actually heard a discussion about this exact thing earlier today with Simon Milner from Facebook and Claire Perry, MP, child abuse advisor to the PM. And they were saying that, yes, some, you know, big companies like Facebook are kind of leading the way, but how do you make all the other companies follow? And they were talking about perhaps implementing a fine if they don't respond to people's complaints within 48 hours, because that's exactly the problem they were citing, that they're not taking it seriously and they're not getting back to people sometimes at all.
Yeah. But how are those fines going to be enforced? I mean, this is the thing that would be so small, because I imagine that these reports are probably made far more often for things that aren't legitimate causes for concern, and they're just basically someone who's really pissed off with an idiot online.
But have to then be a separate body saying, yes, you should be fine because this is a legitimate complaint. They'd be doing the job twice.
That's the problem. Facebook has an awful lot of noise. They say that they'll have people making comments about how they don't like Justin Bieber's album or One Direction's latest album, and someone will report that as being bullying or harassment. And so that's wasting their time.
Yeah, but it borders more into this sort of, is it libel, is it opinion sort of thing. Like, it's not libel to say that you hate someone's album, but...
Yeah, exactly. But if you say, I'm going to go and attack this band because they're so terrible on Tuesday where they're playing at the Coco's, then, you know, maybe they would.
I found loads of sites like that on Facebook when I was doing a feature, and it was there were several, which was Justin Bieber should be beheaded. If you want us to behead him like this 10,000 times, and we'll do it. Stuff
to be
like
honest,
that.
Though, those exist for far worse even than that. I mean, that's going down another road, I think, than just basic harassment. But I mean, I think the problem with something like Twitter is that the virality and the immediacy of tweets, of retweets, of reposts means that if you're not acting on something within minutes, you're at risk of it becoming a much larger problem. There's no way to step in and to moderate that kind of activity, because it's just by its design so immediate.
And I think Facebook's real world, real name policy makes it much, much easier to police. You know, I mean, obviously you can set up a fake profile on Twitter, but it's harder to do that than on Twitter, where I think Stan Collymore said he had one troll who actually set up 700 different accounts that each would send out 3 or 4 tweets with racist abuse before they'd get blocked. And so it's that kind of behavior that is very hard to stop and makes Twitter's job a bit harder. But the problem is they're not being that good at engaging publicly with the problem. And I think they need to do a bit more there.
Mm. I was wondering if when you were carrying out your research, did you come across any cases where a crime actually went to police that wasn't involving a very high profile or celebrity case? Or because all the ones I can think of are like Caroline Criado Perez, or there was Tom Daley, or there was like a bomb threat to an airport, which was, you know, got blown out of proportion.
Well, I guess Paul Chambers was a case of someone who wasn't well known initially. I think the problem is high media profile and media attention pushes things up the list when it comes to the police having to handle it, because it's potentially really embarrassing, as the case with the Twitter joke trial was. Well, it wasn't the police, it was the Crown Prosecution Service. But yes, having a high, making it more high profile gets more attention, and that will push it up the agenda.
Even Chambers, he's a journalist, isn't he? So
yes,
presumably it was already in the public.
I think maybe in terms of, as far as legislation and police is concerned, I suppose it's in that you have to sort of potentially drown before you learn how to swim. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the period that we're in at the moment, is that no one really knows how to do this. And there's going to be some screw-ups.
Yeah.
And there's going to be some high-profile mistakes before people start working out the severity of the problem here and figure out a way around it. But I mean, Liv's piece is fascinating, lengthy, well worth a couch-based read with a coffee. And you can find that if you go to wired.co.uk and search Ugly Business. Well, that's going to do it for the show this week, and you can get in touch and let us know what you think about any of the topics we have discussed today, particularly if you have any views on online harassment and your views on our opinions of how it should or should not be handled. That's podcast@wired.co.uk. Also, of course, on Facebook, you're very welcome to post there, facebook.com/wiredUK, and obviously on Twitter @wiredUK. We will see you in 1 week's time.
Bye.
Bye. Thrilling stuff.
It really is. I can feel the excitement in my waters.
I like the variety of voices.